Given that my mother is a teacher, I always enjoy, and of course that I've had lots of education myself and many fine teachers, I always enjoy having people on the show who are themselves teachers and have dedicated their lives to this very important field. Today we'll be speaking with Steve DeAngelis, who is a science teacher, Nordic ski coach, and half-time dean of students at Marina Cook High School in Readfield. Thanks so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Well, thanks for letting me come. It's nice of you.
I'm really impressed with your memory of Nordic ski history. It goes back almost as far as my graduation from high school. And that says a lot, because it was a while ago. I graduated in 88, and you were remembering people that used to ski on the team that I was with at Yarmouth.
That's because they used to squash us like bugs. And so they were really good. They were our idols. When I first started coaching skiing, Bob Morse had been at it for a while at Yarmouth, and he still is, which is pretty impressive. I want to talk about someone who's been around a long time, but the Yarmouth teams were the teams that when I first started coaching, we were in last and they were in first, and we always, you know, that was our model. We wanted to emulate them. So we got to the point where we could compete with them pretty successfully. So that's good.
Yeah, you actually have done a great job with the Marina Cook group. And it's something that I guess why I'm so impressed with this is that, I mean, this is a decades-long project that you've been working on. Why Nordic skiing?
You know, I've coached other sports as well, but I stuck with Nordic skiing for a couple of reasons. One is I love being outdoors, and it's still something I can do with them every day. So when we're at practice every day, I'm skiing with the kids, you know. And that's hard to do that. You know, as a basketball coach my age, you're really not running up and down the court very much with the high school kids if you're playing it. But I can still ski with most of them, except the very fastest ones now. But so that's always been a big part of it. But the other reason is really related to how much I love teaching, because teaching and coaching are really the same thing in different places. And for me, coaching is, especially Nordic skiing, is a great way to teach some of the life lessons that I want my kids to learn. You know, it's a sport that requires intrinsic motivation to be good at. You know, nobody comes out for Nordic skiing because they're like, oh, I'm going to be on the front page of the paper. There's going to be big crowds cheering me, you know. Because, no, if you're a Nordic skier in Maine and you're really successful, your parents and a couple of other people might be there at the race. And when you cross the line, you'll have drool coming out of your mouth and, you know, a big snot thing coming down your chin probably, you know, and if you'd had a really good race. And, you know, and it can be 20 below zero and you're still out there skiing in this great wind chill or whatever. And so you have to be intrinsically motivated. And you also have to deal with the elements, like whatever you're given on a given day. It's not the same, you know. Every basketball gym is pretty close the same. You know, the rim's the same height and so forth, but every trail is different. The weather's different. The wax is different. You name it. It's all different. You have to adapt. So those are great life lessons. And the other cool, cool thing about Nordic skiing that makes me crazy passionate about it is that it's a neat blend of individual and team. Like, we always do better, I think, because we work incredibly well with the team. It's a tradition on our team that the older kids work with the younger kids. At the start of the season, we have like 40, 50 kids on the team, and I'm often the only person there, the only adult. They know that if we're going to get better, they have to teach the younger kids, and so that's part of the tradition. That builds great teamwork, but also we have a full range, and out of those 40 kids that we had this year, there are some who had never been on skis before, ever, and other kids who were going to be state champions this year. And out of that whole range, it's really great to work with kids to have them meet their own individual goals as well. And their individual goals don't have to be state champion. It can be to, you know, make it through a race without falling. And it's awesome to watch kids grow and change in a way that is almost without public notice, that it's all within, you know, themselves. And I think that's an awesome thing to learn how to do to reach those kind of goals.
As you're talking about the elements and the snot and the breathlessness and the
I shouldn't mention those things. That's not much of an advertising, is
well,
it?
but it's very true. I mean, it isn't really a glamorous sport, and it's not one that you do because you're looking for crowd support. I mean, there's a very dedicated group of parents that are extremely supportive of their Nordic skiers. They bundle up, they go to the races, they'll ski out onto the course, you know, they'll watch their skier come around the bend. But it requires a lot to get out there. So it's not like this is the sport that you'll get a lot of school cheerleaders out there lending support for. I remember when I was doing it, my memories were mostly of being in the middle of the woods, usually by myself, and having it be very cold.
Is that because you were winning the races?
Exactly. What it was.
Just
sure. And, you know, facing a giant hill, or whether I was at the top or at the bottom. I mean, and there was so much of it there. I was always having this conversation with myself, like, why am I doing this? And do I really want to do this? Do I want to be faster? Does it really matter? And maybe I think you're right. I think there is this something that goes on inside of you that a lot of people don't ever really need to deal with until they get older.
Well, I work with the kids very much on meeting those individual goals, and we always talk about getting the most you have out of whatever you have in you on that given day. Because some days you feel great, some days you don't feel great, some days it's all clicking, some days it's not. But the key is whatever you got and whatever the condition are, you get the very best out of yourself. So I always sit with it. I've worked out a thing where I work back one seat at a time on the bus on the way to all the meets and talk to every kid about what their goals are for that race. And on the way back, I do the same thing. I work back, talk to every kid and kind of debrief, you know, how'd it go? What goals, what did they learn today? What goals did they meet? What goals didn't they meet? Where are we going to go from here? You know, and that's like just a great chance to teach kids lessons and make connections with kids outside the classroom.
And you described also the social aspect. You know, some of my best friends are people that I did not ski before, Nordic ski, before I went to high school. So I started as a freshman as a Nordic skier, first time on skis. And thank God they were doing skate skiing and not so much traditional skiing, because I could do skate skiing. I could learn that along with everybody else. Traditional skiing, not so much. But some of my best friends were my fellow ski team members. They're still my best friends. They're people that I've, you know, stayed close to all these years, because you're on the ski bus and it's dark and it's cold and, you know, there's just...
It's awesome that you mentioned the ski bus, because we just had our awards a couple of weeks ago for this season, and the kids talked nonstop about how it feels like a 40-person family.
That's right.
You know, and that was one of the reasons. They said, well, you know, you're stuck on these ski buses forever. You're in the wax room forever. You're like, spend almost... We laugh and joke in the ski team that really that your priorities in life during the winter are family first, academic second, and ski team third, and social life really isn't even on the list, because the social life is only involved with the ski team. And after that, because you don't really have time for anything else if you pay attention to those three things really well, you know.
So you're now in the off season for skiing, and you're still very busy because you're still a teacher, you're still a half-time dean of students. Mm-hmm. How do you stay physically active?
That's a good question. It's not always easy to do all the kind of endurance training that I want. You know, that I would undoubtedly spend much longer time-wise out skiing or running if I didn't have the job I have. So it's kind of a trade-off, right? But, you know, I work it into other things that I do. Like we have a little sugar house we built out back of the house in Reedfield, and we just got done. We had our last boiling this last weekend, and it's got too warm now. But, you know, I was thinking about, you know, just last week I was out carrying these 5-gallon buckets of sap through the woods and 2 feet of snow on snowshoes. And, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, I'm going out for a workout, but you're getting a workout, a really good workout, you know. And so I think a lot of what I get to do, I build it in little bits as part of our daily routine. We have a lot of land in Reedfield, and we have a Christmas tree farm, a grow your own Christmas tree farm. That works out great because all the work for that's in the summertime, and a lot of mowing and walking in the woods for that. We have a woodlot. We cut all our own firewood, and I split it all by hand because I like to do it. So, you know, it's kind of like just fits in with the flow of life, all right? And it helps me to stay safe, relatively fit that way. My kids like to tease me that I'm really skinny and wiry and look little, but I have old man strength.
Old man strength.
Which just comes from, you know, just... doing stuff, you know.
Well, I commented to you as you were coming in that you do look remarkably youthful, considering that you've been coaching as far back as when I was skiing.
You don't have to keep going on the far back part as much. You know, you could like lighten up on that a little bit, probably. No, just
easy. But Bob Morse, you've already mentioned, my ski coach. I mean, he was doing it long before I got there. He's still doing it. He looks pretty much the same.
He
and I
really
see
does.
Him now. He looks pretty much exactly the same.
He's had that gigantic mustache forever, and he looks very much the same. And he's still out there skiing too with the kids. He's doing amazingly well. It's a it's an awesome sport. I keep going back to it, but great stuff.
It is a great sport. You also have quite a lot of educational background yourself. In addition to your Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from the University of Maine at Orono, you also have a Master's of Education in Counseling from Orono. So you've done science, you've done counseling, this education piece. So you, in addition to this physical thing that you do with the skiing, you have this intellectual aspect of you as well. So talk to me about how that whole progression was made. Chemical engineering is a very difficult major. Why did you decide to go from there to education, to teaching, counseling? How did that all come together?
Oh, that's an awesome question, actually. That's a great question. I graduated from Maine with a chemical engineering degree, like you said, and I worked for Scott Paper Company in first in Winslow and then up near Skowhegan. And they were doing a startup of a mill there at the time, and it was really interesting work, really challenging, super financially rewarding, very intense because we were doing the startup. But then after a couple of years of that, it was just about a little less than 2 years, it felt, it's really hard to describe, but I just felt like I wanted to be doing something more for other people than I was, which really hadn't occurred to me a great deal going through high school and college. I loved science. I loved the nerdy stuff. Love thinking about and figuring out things, love math, and my dad was involved in the science field, and so it just made sense to me. I'm just going to do that. And it was, in all honesty, I just did it because I was good at it. It made sense to me. And then I started looking around at my job after a couple of years, and I still remember distinctly, there was this older fellow there who had been there for a number of years, worked for Scott, anyway, not at that place. And I asked him. He didn't seem that interested in his job, so I asked him, well, what are you still doing this for? And I started just thinking about it a little bit. He says, oh, son, they got the golden handcuffs on me, you know, which just meant he said, if I quit this job, my wife would not get to drive the car she does, my kids, you know, the golden handcuffs. And that just still resonates with me today. It really resonated with me then. I was like, I don't want golden handcuffs. And just so I started looking around. Just really with no idea, and of course, no internet at the time. This is back, as you pointed out, a long time ago. And so I was looking in want ads and stuff like that, and I was reading the Sunday paper, and I saw a picture of the principal at Marana Cook School. It had just started up in 1976. This was in 78. And he was sitting in the hall with his arm around a kid. And I'm like, that does not look like the principal of my high school. And it just interested me. I kind of tucked it away. And then it was just serendipity. 2 weeks later, I saw an ad. This was in the early August for a chemistry teacher at Marana Cook, and I'm like, how hard can that be? I'm a chemical engineer. I can teach chemistry. And it was, when I look back, I was like incredibly arrogant to think, because I mean, you know, I'm like, I'm a big, bad chemical engineer. You know, the education majors had it so soft in college. That's what I was thinking. And so I was like, I applied for it just on a whim. I'd never had an education course in my life, never student taught. So I'm like, yeah, they're not going to interview me. They called me up. They asked me to come interview. And it was a pretty experimental place that I was into the open school concept, and they were willing to take risks, and they took a giant risk. I remember they called me back like 2 days later after this grueling interview, and I thought, well, that's all we're done with. And they called me back and offered me the job, and I seriously asked them if they had the wrong number. I thought they had called the wrong person. And so they said, no, this is you're the one we want, like to offer this job to. And I was like, and it was just a gut feeling. I said, okay, I'm going to apply. I'm going to take it. And this was like 2 weeks before school started in August. And so I took that job, and it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. It was like just such, talk about an awakening. It's like, really? Oh, that's what it's like. You know, it was just brutally hard. I mean, in part because I had never student taught, never had an education course in my life. And, you know, but I had an awesome, a wonderful, wonderful department chair who really helped pull me along for the first couple of years. I got lucky. I got hooked in with some other physics teachers up in Waterville. Mike Goslin was one of them, who had been doing it for a lot longer. And they taught me a lot more about the teaching aspect of it, not just the content. I started out teaching chemistry, but then, like a lot of things, when you teach something, you can get really, all of a sudden, like the light goes on. And the first year I'd teach one physics course, which was the hardest thing for me as an engineer. I never, even though I was successfully working as an engineer, I didn't really totally get it. Taught that for a year, and about halfway through the year, I remember thinking, oh my God, that's how this works? I totally get that now. And so then I just fell in love with physics and started doing that all the time, and wound up doing a lot of work over the summers and continuing education with physics. And now when I teach, that's all I teach is physics. And so that's kind of a That's the short version.
The short version.
It's a lot longer, but we'll give you the short version.
So how about this Master's of Education in Counseling? Mm-hmm. Why the counseling piece?
Well, because Maranica has an awesome advisor system, a really, really wonderful thing where each teacher in the building and most of the administrators even have a group of 10 to 12 students that they follow through. They take them in as ninth graders and follow them through to 12th graders, not just in homeroom. You have days out with them. You do like a number of extended activities beyond just a homeroom every day. And the other key piece that I think sets Maranica apart, I think it's the reason I've stayed there, is I feel that we do a great job of educating the whole person, really paying attention to like helping them become mature adults and learn how to communicate and work with other people, things that go beyond just the content of your courses. And I felt that if I was going to be after the first couple of years, I thought, if I'm going to be a really good advisor, I've got a chemical engineering degree, no education background, I got to learn some more. So I took a leave of absence for a couple of years and got a counseling degree, mostly to help me to be a better advisor. And I came back.
How does that help you with your dean of students position that you do half-time?
A great deal, as it turned out. I always resisted that for a long time. I've been there since 1978, and so with the exception of that 2 years off to get my master's in counseling. And so as I got older and had been around for a while, people kept asking me, do you want to be principal? Do you want to go into administration? I always said no, because I really, really, really love working with students, with kids. Teenagers are, they keep me vibrant. It's the best. And it's still the best. I love, love, love working with teenagers. And so then about 3.5 years ago, one of the two deans of students positions opened up. And we have half-time dean of students because we feel it's important that the people in that role also stay in touch with the teaching side of things. So rather than having a full-time assistant principal, we have two deans of students who both half-time and teach half-time. We share the dean of students part. And nobody from in school applied for it. They're going to open it up to outside of the school. And I just felt like we needed to have someone who knew the way the school operated to be able to do it. So I did it really not because I wanted to. I still was pretty convinced that was not a good idea. I really missed, and I missed the teaching still. But it's turned out to be a really good thing for me, because that's where the counseling piece comes in. I really spend, like when I teach physics, I spend half my time with students who really, for the most part, love school. They're into school. They're good at school. They get it. They like it. Want to do it, spend their time at it. And then in my dean of students role, I spend half my time with a lot of kids who really don't like school, school's a struggle for them for various reasons. And, my thinking about that part of the job is I don't want to be seen as kind of the assistant principal who is the head knocker, just like out there like knocking heads to get people to do it. I want to be as proactive as possible. So my goal is to get to know all the students that I work with as before they get in trouble. So you have a relationship first. So when a kid's doing something that they shouldn't be doing and you have to call them on it, you call them on it like the same reason you call your own children on something. You call them because you love them and because you want them to be successful. And you know that if they can just skate around, do whatever they want, that's going to be a struggle for them, at some point. And so I try to be as proactive as possible in that job, get to know the kids first, get to kind of head off issues. So, one of my crowning achievements after doing it for a couple of years was one of the students in our alt ed program. His teacher overheard him say, "Oh man, I would just crack that kid, except Mr. D would find out about it before I ever did it anyway. So there's no point, And I was like, "Yeah, that's awesome," because I just said that he knows I'm looking, he knows I care about him, knows that So it's like proactive stuff. So if that can happen, that's the best, and that's the counseling part.
I'm thinking about sort of the parallels between education and health. Obviously, health is what I'm in, and I'm a family mm-hmm. doctor. And you've come to a place where there's Common Core, standardized testing, no child left behind. Medicine has come to a place where we're asked to uphold certain standards. We're constantly being evaluated not only on whether we're good at being doctors, but whether we're good at talking to our patients. And ultimately, in both cases, it's hard for us to be measured on relationships, and yet those end up being probably the most important part of both fields. So how do you stay kind of focused on the importance of the relationship when what you're being told from the outside is we need you to meet these external goals that we think are important?
Well, in a way, I'm kind of lucky because I have been teaching for a long time, and I know in my heart what works. And I know that if your students know that, I mean, the most important thing I think for a teacher is to be passionate about your subject and what you teach and passionate about kids. Because if your kids know, if your students know you care about them, you want to do your very best for them, that empowers them, that motivates them. And without that, you can have the best standards in the world, all kinds of standards testing, and it's not going to work for you. You got to have that relationship, you know? That's another key part about being a teacher is just being able to meet kids where they are, to connect with them and understand why this kid is learning it differently than someone else. And that takes time. That takes that relationship building. And I know that if you can do that, that's the starting piece. And then I really think that I like the idea of Common Core, by the way. Well, at least as applied to science, certainly. I don't know as much about it for English and math, although certainly our teachers are working hard on that. But the what's called the Next Generation Science Standards were just adopted, actually, by Maine. They're great. It's basically saying these are the things that people who really know the field think are most important to learn. I like that part. I think where I really very seriously differ is our emphasis on doing lots and lots and lots of standardized testing to prove that we're teaching that, because it takes time away from teaching, and it takes the emphasis away from, puts the emphasis too much on content and not enough on knowing how to figure stuff out and how to learn. Because that's my big goal with my students is when I teach physics, I'm thinking less about, it's important that you know these equations and this content. Matter of fact, we don't have memorized equations. They always wonder, as we learn new equations, we put them up on a big poster and it's on the wall and they're all around the room. We don't have to memorize that? Nope, you need to know how to use them, okay? And what's most critical, I think, is that we teach people not the content so much, but how to learn and how to figure things out. Because if you know a whole bunch of content, you can't possibly know all the content in the world. Nobody can. So if you're working on something and it's something you're not familiar with and you don't know how to learn and don't know how to figure stuff out, that's a problem. So that's really the emphasis, I think, needs to be on that. But the relationships come first.
I'm thinking about my own science teachers, because obviously to go to medical school, I needed to first take physics and calculus and algebra and all the things that led up to all of these things.
Your listeners cannot see the face you made when you talked about physics and calculus, but I could.
It just is not. You know what? I actually had some really great teachers in those fields, and the reason why that was important for me was because I didn't really have a physics mind. I didn't really have a, if there is one. I mean, but I didn't learn it the way that it is traditionally taught. So I always really appreciated the teachers that were able to come around to my way of looking at it, you know, which was, I don't know, I like to write, I like to sing, I like to, you know, I like to
That's
do
great.
Those
yeah.
things.
Oh,
but I always really appreciated the teachers who could help me learn it in a way that maybe non-science people were learning it. Mm-hmm. I guess my question though to you is part of all this education background that you have now and the counseling background that you have now, are you seeing that we're progressing in terms of helping different learning styles feel better about being within the educational system?
I'm going to give that a yes and a no, because there's certainly good research out there about that. And I feel like there's a lot of individual teachers, certainly that some of the young teachers coming into the field, they are so far ahead in terms of pedagogy where we were 30 years ago, right? But the challenge is to be able to really use that pedagogy in a good way, and that's because the demands on schools and teachers are pretty extreme, I think, pretty tough. So it's hard to be able to really apply those that research that's out there and the skills and knowledge that teachers have in the very best way. And I really think mostly that comes down to a thing that we struggle with in our country, and that's equity. What I mean by that really is equal access to equally good educations for everybody in the country. You know, and that's a really big change. That's something that we don't have in our country, that there's a struggle. A lot of times, you know, people are politicians and the people, kind of the movers and shakers, and are constantly saying, we need to fix the schools, right? But you can't fix the schools in a vacuum, right? When you look at, you know, they're fond of pointing to standardized test scores from around the world, and they say, well, you know, Finland is like at the very top, and the U.S. is in the middle of the pack, just kind of an also-ran. How can that happen? But it didn't happen by accident. 40 years ago, Finland was at the bottom, you know? And how did they get there? They didn't start by fixing the schools. they got there by achieving equity for their people. They said, oh, we need to have universal daycare. So if parents are working, every child gets free daycare. They get medical care. You know, they get the, so that, because when kids are coming to school hungry from an alcoholic household, from a place where they're not cared for, they've never seen a dentist, they don't have a medical care, learning math is not their priority. Their needs, the old hierarchy of needs, right? That's pretty far down the hierarchy of needs if you're hungry. And so it's really interesting because Finland started not by fixing the schools, they started by achieving equity for the people in their country. And then they also decided, we're not going to do standardized testing. We're going to train teachers incredibly well. You have to have a master's degree in Finland to be able to teach. Only the top 10% of students who apply for education school get in. It's like getting into law school or med school here, you know? And they make it a priority. And then, you know, a lot of times people say, well, that's a small, homogenous country. It'll never work in the United States. But there's certain models that I think we could apply much better. And I really, that's what it all comes down to, is kind of a lack of true equity. You know, we say we have a public school system that's open to everybody, but public schools are not the same. And we also have a lot of private schools where a lot of the very best students whose parents can afford it can send them to those, you know, and that's another thing. In Finland, there are no private schools. And how do they kick our butts on those tests? The difference from the top to the bottom, our top students perform just about as well as theirs do. But their bottom students are so much closer to their top students than ours are. We have this gigantic gap in Finland that's just, it's much tighter. And I think we could do better in that regard.
What you just said actually reminds me of my conversations with my mother, the teacher, and my father, the doctor, for the last 40 years. I mean, it's pretty much that. It is that it's not even always about education. It's about access to food, and it's about access to social services, and it's about poverty, and, you know, and so I think it must be very interesting as a teacher to have people constantly pointing a finger saying, you need to do this better, when you're saying, well, how am I supposed to be this child's parent, counselor, doctor, social worker? Frustrating.
In some ways, but, you know, I definitely think of it on two levels. When I'm right there in the middle of it, it's not frustrating because for me it's a challenge, it's a passion, it's something I really want to help kids do, and I feel like I can make a difference for kids who, the system is what it is, and those kids are in it, well, let's do the very best we can with them and help them. So that's not frustrating, you know, on a daily basis in that regard. It's frustrating on a big scale. I probably shouldn't say these kind of things, but on the radio, but, you know, my family knows that in my heart of hearts, what I'd really like to be is the benevolent dictator of the at least the country, if not the world. And I promise I'd be benevolent, mostly so I could work on things like that. Because I feel like if we just could set a direction that truly takes care and keep it for a while. You know, we like reinvent education every 4 years. We try that. Oh, it didn't work in 4 years. Let's just try something else. And you know, Finland stayed the course for 40 years. 40 years. That's why they are where they are. You know, and so. Anyway, if there ever is a chance to, you know, work on my benevolent dictatorship campaign, I hope you'll be on it.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't have it any other way, as long as you're benevolent.
Exactly.
So, Miranda Cook, one doesn't necessarily think, you know, we know that we have great schools in Maine. Miranda Cook is in Reedfield. Reedfield is not, it's a beautiful town. And it's not in the middle of a booming metropolis. But somehow you've managed to have good schools there, and you've managed to have, there are good schools all over the state that it's not necessarily related to people's income levels. If you're in a place that doesn't necessarily have, it's not necessarily a bedroom community to a large urban center, how does one create a good school system?
It's not like a Cape Elizabeth or a Falmouth right on the doorstep of Portland by any means. But some of our towns, Manchester, for example, is a very much a bedroom community. And so, and Reedfield itself is really to Augusta, to a lot of state workers and, you know, a lot of professionals. And so certainly if you look at the overall socioeconomic, on the average in our country, in our district rather, it's probably not the highest, but it's not the bottom either. So, I mean, we're incredibly well supported by our communities. They really turn out for us at budget time and really support the school. So I do think we're very well supported in that regard. The other thing I think is that we do have a lot of people who appreciate the value of a good education. You know, they know that it's important, and so they also support us for that reason, you know. And I think, though, that we were fortunate. That school that started in 1976, kind of in this really experimental time, really had this mission to make the focus on the overall well-being of the children, you know. And we've managed to sustain that. You know, it's gone through lots of roller coaster rides. It's not all just smooth sailing, and it's not perfect. It's not a perfect place to teach. But I feel like at its core, like our core mission and the sense that you get when you walk in that school, it feels different. I've been in a lot of schools around the States. I work a lot with other teachers, and I still think Marana Cook feels really different. It just feels like a place where kids are, in general, pretty darn happy to be, you know. It's hard because I think, you know, I look at some of the smaller schools in more rural Western Maine than we are, just a little bit further west and out there. And it's a challenge because what I notice is, like, in their participation in co-curricular things especially, it's getting harder and harder and harder. And as I talk to other coaches and teachers in those areas, they say a big part of it is that, you know, both their parents, if they have both parents home, are working. Or they might be in a single-parent household where they feel like they also need to be working instead of... So it's harder for kids to be kids in some places than in others, you know, if that makes sense to you. And I think that has a dramatic impact because if... To me, one of the other things I really want to help my students learn to appreciate and value is the value of being a lifelong learner, you know? But it comes down to that hierarchy of needs again. That's easier to do when your basic needs are being met, you know? And if your basic needs aren't met, it's hard to take that vision of, oh, it's really important to learn for a lifetime, you know?
You're not originally, your family's not originally from Maine.
That's correct.
When you were 12, your dad came to Maine for a job. You love Maine. You got job offers in other states. Why did you stay here?
Like a lot of things. I'm not a big believer in super simple solutions to anything or explanations. There's a lot of reasons, but I remember that when we came to Maine, we came from West Virginia, and we came in the middle of the winter, and a week after we got here, we had one of the biggest snowstorms in the history of the state of Maine, and we got out of school for a week. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. This must happen all the time, which it doesn't, but still, that just right then and there, I just fell in love with being in the snow. I love the snow. I love being outdoors. And Maine is a great place to raise a family. The one reason I stayed, one reason I didn't go for jobs in other states, I wasn't looking to raise a family. I wasn't married at the time when I first got out of college. But I just thought to myself, this is, you know, as I looked at some of the other places, I got job offers in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and different places. And it just, Maine was clearly, in my mind, a great place to raise a family. And I thought, someday I want to raise a family.
And now you have?
Now I have three children. Who are just wonderful. Hannah, my oldest daughter, is 25, and she's been working in Boston. She got out of Colby College in 2012. She's been working in Boston for a few years, but she's moving back to Portland this summer, which is great. We're excited about that. She hopes to, she's doing in the tutoring and counseling field right now, and I think she's going to hopefully go to USM and get her master's in counseling. And my son Tyler is a senior at Bowdoin. He's going to graduate in about a month. And after spending next winter in Europe skiing. He's on the Nordic ski team at Bowdoin right now. I'm pretty confident he's going to be back around Maine also. And my son Luca is a junior in high school. And he's also a Nordic skier and wants to go ski in college. And then he wants to be Secretary of State someday. So maybe when I'm benevolent dictator, he can be Secretary of State. Although I don't know if benevolent dictators really need such a thing. And my wife Tara is amazing. And she is a counselor in the elementary schools in two of the schools. Towns in our district. So, and it's a great place to raise kids. When I still remember when Luca was in middle school, we were driving home from school one fall day. It was just beautiful. We drove right by the end of the lake and all these fall colors out. And he just out of the blue, he says, Dad, you know what? We live in a place where other people come for vacation. And so the kids all get it. I get it. You know, it's a great place to live for a lot of reasons. But if you love the outdoors, it's a great place to live.
Well, I agree with you, and I appreciate all the work you're doing, all the students you've helped teach and counsel, all the kids that you've